I'm Jane Williams. This is the Red Eye Podcast. You can hear our live broadcast on Saturday mornings from 10 till noon at 100.5 FM in the Lower Mainland. On the podcast today, Alpha Abibis on who and what is being obscured in the current surge of Canadian patriotism. Patriotism has surged across Canada in response to Donald Trump's attacks on our economic stability and sovereignty. This had a dramatic effect on the fortunes of the Conservative Party, resulting in a fourth term for the Liberal Party in Monday's election. Actor Jeff Douglas revived his iconic I Am Canadian beer ad from 2000, recast as We Are Canadian, with the familiar Canadian symbols front and center, from hockey games to peacekeeping missions and poutine. In the midst of all this rallying behind the flag, Alpha Abibi says it's a good time to consider who and what is being obscured behind this version of Canadian patriotism. Alpha Abibi is an associate professor with the Faculty of Humanities and the lead for Africa and Black Diaspora Studies at McMaster University. She joins me today from Scarborough. Hello, Alpha.
Hello, Jane. Good to be here.
Good to have you. You're a scholar of migration and diasporas. What changes have you noted to the Canadian population in recent years?
I think the changes that I've noted as a scholar are ones that we see on the street. Anyone sort of with their eyes open walking the streets of Canada, certainly in the metropolitan cities. So migration has always been a defining feature of the Canadian landscape, and that has continued, but the nature of that migration has shifted over the years. So the flow and the increase of flow of migration, but also the source countries in terms of where people are coming to Canada from. And so what we see is an increasingly diverse Canadian landscape and population. But also not only thinking about newcomers, when we look at people who are born and raised in Canada, people like myself, for example, we have a higher proportion of the Canadian population who are children of immigrants. And so people who are straddling connections to multiple cultures and places in the world. And so this was something that was, again, always part of the Canadian experience and story, but maybe more of a fraction than a majority. But we're increasingly moving towards a majority of the population that straddle these spaces and geographies and cultures and experiences.
And I understand that Black diasporas are one of the fastest growing segments in Canada.
Yes, they are, definitely. And so you have source countries from continental Africa, like Nigeria and Ethiopia, that have significantly increased the flows to Canada, as well as longstanding historic Black communities that have existed for many, many years, and significant flows from the Caribbean that continue to shape that landscape. But yes, the Black diaspora in Canada is not only increasing in number, but also increasing in diversity in terms of the number of places that people are coming to Canada from.
You've written that these shifts are a direct result of long-term immigration reforms. In other words, a result of a change in government policy. When did those changes start to come about?
Yes. Just to clarify, that I think these changes are in part a reflection of those changing policies, but also lots of other changes, geopolitical shifts, conflict, instability and security, capitalism and rearing its head all over the world. And so there are a lot of things happening at the same time. But certainly on the policy side, we have this notable shift that begins in the 1960s when the immigration laws were liberalized, as they're often described in Canada, but also in the US around the same time. Meaning that explicit discrimination against immigrants from non-European countries is lifted, and there's an opening up of those immigration policies, has a very dramatic effect on the landscape in Canada. And so you have increasing flows from, at the time, places like the Caribbean, East and South Asia, and that kind of rhythm has continued since the 60s. But then you also have a lot of things happening in the geopolitical space around the world that impact different kinds of, I guess, rhythms and flows. So you have decolonization happening around the world in the 60s and 70s. You have some significant global conflicts and refugee and displaced peoples all over the world that are happening in the 80s and 90s, especially in connection to structural adjustment policies and the aftermath in the global south. And so you have this sort of confluence of factors happening around the world as Canada's borders have opened up somehow, and the birth rate in Canada continuing to decline also means that our economy needs these people, right? So these are, it's important not to lean too heavily into the sort of national myth of Canada as this welcoming country, as a purely altruistic impulse. There are mutually beneficial elements here that also are important part of the picture.
Is it true that before the 1960s, there was an explicit white Canada policy?
It is true. It was not described in law as a white Canada policy, but in effect it was. And in the literature, it's a common phrase used to describe a menu of policies that cumulatively and pulled together essentially amounted to a white Canada policy. And that's connected to public discourse at the time that also really emphasized those sort of values and principles as well. So, and matches and tracks as well in terms of the immigration flows at that time.
Now, despite all the changes that have happened since, the present day reality of Canada isn't reflected in the current surge of patriotism. Was that a surprise to you?
I don't think it was a surprise as someone with lived experience. So myself, I'm, born in Canada to parents who came from Ethiopia and East Africa and grew up in this context and has sort of paid attention from a personal perspective and doing a lot of community work, but also as a scholar paying attention to this. So, I've been, for better or worse, well-versed in some of the contradictions in the ways in which Canada presents itself versus what that looks like on the ground. However, for myself and for many people around me who, I was having conversations about this with, I think it all came really quickly and with a lot of fervor. And it was a little unsettling. And by that, I mean, I don't think any of us could really have predicted what's, happened geopolitically, but also in Canada over the last few months. It all seems like a bit of a fever dream, to be honest. But that sort of wave of patriotism that came very suddenly. It's not something we're very used to in Canada. That real explicit, unapologetic Canadian nationalism is not something we've seen part of the public discourse for quite a long time. And so I would say, yes, I was surprised by the speed and the fervor and the pitch, but not surprised that some of those inconsistencies and contradictions emerged as that came, because this is something that is very, very well documented in the literature, is part of the public debate as well. So yeah, I wasn't surprised to see that emerge.
When you say contradictions and inconsistencies, can you unpack that a little bit for me?
Yes, for sure. So we have a version of Canadianness that's a particular story, right? It's a particular story about Canada as a nation that has very specific features. Those features lean much more heavily on the sort of Anglo-Saxon elements of the Canadian experience. There is a way in which Indigenous histories, stories, and contemporary and present realities are erased from much of that public discourse. And there is a very muted way in which Canada has engaged with multiculturalism and its diversity in the way that it presents itself as a nation. And so when I say some of those contradictions, part of what I mean is we have a reality of First Nations and Indigenous communities, an unceded territory that's very much a part of the founding of this land. And we have multiple waves of migration over the decades that have shifted the landscape and shifted the relationship and the stories that people have to this land that we're on. And we haven't had a lot of space, I think, to readily reconcile some of those differences. And so when there was a need to rise up and, push the elbows out, as they said, and to kind of move forward with a united vision, there was this really knee-jerk reaction to pull from the stock imagery and the stock stories and tropes that existed that really resonate, I would say, with only a segment of the population and increasingly fewer and fewer people across the nation.
What do the young people that you come across in your teaching and your academic leadership roles say about nationalism?
I have the pleasure of teaching some really dynamic young people in my role as a professor at McMaster, and I've also done a lot of work in youth engagement and community. And, you know, something that I often say about young people, particularly the generation right now, for all the ways in which they get a lot of flack, I think, in our public discourse around young people, they have a really low tolerance for hypocrisy, which I find really refreshing and inspiring. And so for the students who I speak with about this, both people with a history of immigration or connection to immigration, as well as folks who are maybe multi-generationally Canadian and of European ancestry, I think there's a real understanding that the version of multiculturalism, let's say, the multicultural narrative of Canada that they've inherited and learned in elementary school, for example, and see in mainstream public discourse, is very disconnected from the reality that they're seeing on the ground and at odds with some of their ideological commitments and social justice commitments. So, for example, there's this narrative of immigrants being welcomed into Canada, but on the ground, a real issue around accreditation of foreign credentials, real challenges in the labor market. And young people see this, right? They see this in their families. They see this in their communities. They see this when they're driving an Uber and their driver was a surgeon, you know, back home. Like this, these are things that they're very attuned to. And, you know, I think that this is something that they are paying close attention to, and they're asking really critical questions of the national stories that, you know, we're sharing and the realities on the ground. And I think there's a lot to pay attention to there and to really be in conversation with them about how we might shift and move towards a more reflective and honest national conversation. And the thing I'll just add as well is we have a generation of young people who have come up at a time when we've done a lot of reckoning with our Indigenous histories and the ugly side of that history, including the conversations around residential schools. And so I think more than ever, from my perspective, you have a generation of young people who are demanding that we really reconcile our understanding of Canada as a nation state in relation to the good and the bad, and part of that being settler colonial history that's at the very root of our root as a country.
The majority of Canadians are definitely united in opposition to Trump's threats to our sovereignty. Do you think there's the same level of opposition to his attacks on immigrants?
That's a really interesting question. I think there's a surface answer to that and then maybe a more complicated answer. So, you know, I think on the surface, Canadians still have a real attachment to the idea that we are a country of immigrants and a country that embraces multiculturalism. But when you scratch the surface, and especially in precarious times such as we are in right now, you see that immigrants and newcomers, racialized immigrants and newcomers in particular, are often the first to be thrown under the bus, also in Canada, right? And so you see, for example, you know, the ways in which East Asians were profiled post-COVID. You see the ways in which South Asian people and Arab people have been profiled and thrown under the bus post 9/11, and the ways in which people from India and other South Asian countries have been, again, profiled and thrown to the wolves more recently in the debates around international students, for example. So you see that in sort of in public discourse, but also very much capitalized upon by policymakers and politicians and political hopefuls. So I think this is another contradiction and a disconnect between the way we like to imagine ourselves as a country, but also the ways in which newcomers and immigrants and racialized people in general are often the scapegoats to what are often much more complex structural issues that we're dealing with, such as income insecurity.
Crises can present opportunities for critically rethinking how things have always been done. What kind of Canada would you hope to see come out of the current crisis?
I'd love to see an honest Canada. I think we've seen a lot of really interesting conversations emerge in the last even few weeks, but few months for sure, that's been made possible because of the opposition to Trump. And I think that was partly what prompted my article. It was that, okay, we have this opportunity in this sort of caricature of Trump and all that he represents to revisit the things that we like to say we believe and have a critical conversation about the extent to which that's actually reflected on the ground. So again, for example, thinking about our relationship and our relations with Indigenous communities today, what does that actually look like? You know, we have some very concrete things that we can think about. Access to clean water, for example, in some of these communities, you know, and fights for sovereignty and all of these things. Like, can we have an honest conversation about that? And can that be reflected in the way that we think of ourselves as a country and community? How do we reconcile and make space for the diversity of peoples and experiences on the ground and in really concrete ways? What are the labor market experiences and pathways of immigrant and racialized communities? How are they treated in the educational system? How are we making space for them in positions of leadership and decision-making? And how does that connect with the stories we tell ourselves about who we are as a nation? So if we're looking forward, I think a radical honesty is really important in how we think about a national story. And if we're looking for inspiration in that, where I always look is young people. They will continue to, I think, for me at least, be a North Star of the kinds of conversations that we should be having and what some of our blind spots are.
Well, thank you so much, Alpha. It's been really great to talk with you.
I appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
I've been speaking with Alpha Abebe. She's an associate professor with the Faculty of Humanities and the lead for Africa and Black Diaspora Studies at McMaster University. You can find her article on Canadian patriotism on theconversation.com. It was published on April 17th. You've been listening to the Red Eye Podcast, produced by an independent media collective based in Vancouver. If you enjoyed this episode, it would be great if you left a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps other people to find us. Also, please consider sharing this episode with a friend or telling someone about our podcast. To keep up with the show, you can subscribe to Red Eye wherever you listen to your podcasts. And you can follow us on Blue Sky at Red Eye Radio. I'm Jane Williams. Thanks for listening.